it has been very important to have a good and powerful navy.
Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, commander of Iran's IRGC Navy, said the vessel can carry out combat, logistical, and intelligence-gathering missions in the ocean aimed at establishing stable security in maritime transportation lines and providing assistance to the commercial and fishing fleets belonging to the Islamic Republic and regional countries. U.S. President Donald Trump's new acting defense secretary, Christopher Miller, said last week that Washington will be cutting the number of its deployed troops to Afghanistan and Iraq to 5,000 from 7,500 forces that are currently present there. Just days later, however, the U.S. Central Command said in a statement that two B-52 bombers were deployed to West Asia on short notice to deter what it called potential aggression and reassure U.S. partners and allies in the region. That comes after the New York Times said in a report that Trump had asked his close allies what options were available to take action against Iran's main nuclear site at Natanz. The report adds that the advisors warned the president that a military action could spark a broader conflict in the region.
There have been times that Iran and the United States have been much closer to a war between themselves. So it's not a tough situation right now. The tension is high to some extent, but it's not that high that we would be worried about any possible war. But the United States know that it's not capable of attacking Iran and doing a war, because we have seen for 20 years the situation in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the United States was not capable of fighting against those countries completely, and we were introduced to endless wars because of those two countries. So let alone Iran, which is actually much more powerful and much bigger than those countries.
Some experts are now questioning how such an attack would help Donald Trump while the United States is dealing with political uncertainty over who will control the White House for the next 4 years following a contested election. Donald Trump announced the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran by unilaterally reimposing sanctions on the country. His stance on Iran has been repeatedly criticized internationally, including even by the closest U.S. allies. But Tehran has warned that any aggression by the U.S. against Iran, be it Trump's attempt to distract the American public in the aftermath of the November 3rd election, or an excuse to stay in power, will certainly be met with a crushing response.
Russia says the United States has deceived Moscow, and the international community after it conducted an advanced intercontinental missile interception test. Russia's foreign ministry says the exercise used technology that is part of the Aegis Ashore missile defense system, which the Pentagon had assured the Kremlin was not aimed at Russia's long-range capabilities. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson has described the development as quote-unquote a new confirmation of the dangerous and destabilizing character of Washington's anti-ballistic missile strategy and quote, obvious anti-Russian orientation. Maria Zakharova says the test proved the falsity of American statements, saying, quote, for many years, America assured us that the interception of Russian ICBMs by American standard systems, including this modification, is technically impossible. There are fears the test risks paving the way for Russia testing similar technologies against America's intercontinental ballistic missiles. Moscow has already stated that it reserves the right to take the necessary response measure. On Monday, the U.S. military used the new advanced technology to fire, for the first time, a missile from a warship which downed an ICBM. Previously, the U.S. had promoted the weapons system as being limited against short and intermediate-range missile threats. Russia says this is direct evidence and a concrete example of how Washington manipulated public opinion of its country, lied to its international partners, and justified its actions in the international arena with far-fetched pretexts. Following the collapse of the INF and before the anti-ballistic missile treaty, the only remaining U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control agreement, New START, is also, as things stand, set to expire early next year. Moscow says it hasn't closed the door on negotiations to extend the agreement, formerly known as the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The projected U.S. presidential election winner, Joe Biden, has previously said he will explore the treaty's extension without conditions. However, bilateral relations between the two countries have always been on very shaky grounds. Analysts say the latest American missile test will only escalate military tensions. Amid Russia's worsening relations with NATO, it could not have come at a worse time. Questions have been raised as to whether the U.S. may use the system against Russian military interests. The weapon used to down the ICBM, the Standard Missile 3 or SM-3, is part of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. Moscow has long suspected the system to be a major pathway to a U.S. global missile shield to undermine Russia's military power. The SM-3 missiles have also been deployed close to Russian soil, in Poland and Romania. Moscow says it has repeatedly warned it would take similar measures to ensure national security and maintain a strategic stability. Essentially, that means more sophisticated weapon systems deployed by the adversaries. While suspicions between the U.S. on the one hand and Russia and China on the other spiral out of control.
Bahrain's top diplomat on an official visit to Israel, breaking a long-time taboo. Foreign Minister Abdel Latif Al-Zayani landed in Israel on Wednesday. His controversial trip this week marks the first such visit to Israel by any official from the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Al-Zayani's trip coincides with a visit to Israel by America's top diplomat Mike Pompeo. The Bahraini delegation went on to occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. The top Bahraini diplomat sat down for talks with senior Israeli officials, including his counterpart Gabi Ashkenazi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. Secretary of State was apparently there to facilitate the controversial rapprochement. Al-Zayani's trip, which has angered the Palestinians, is part of a U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between the two sides.
It is obvious that the Trump administration wants to make sure that the normalization process and the what they used to call the deal of the century will be very crucial and strong before they get away from the power in January. So they are doing marathonian steps so that everything will be on the ground and will be very much clear laid out.
Palestinian groups denounced the trilateral meeting between the U.S., Bahrain, and Israel as a clear attack on the rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians want all Arab nations to refrain from establishing ties with Israel until the Israeli occupation is over and a Palestinian state becomes a reality. But as part of a U.S. brokered initiative, Bahrain and its Persian Gulf neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, signed normalization accords with Israel at the White House in mid-September. Sudan has also agreed to normalize ties with Israel as part of a deal that will guarantee much-needed U.S. financial aid. Israel has escalated its violations in the occupied territories over the past years. For instance, it has stepped up settlement construction on occupied lands. The regime has also stepped up demolition of Palestinian homes. So far this year, nearly 700 structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says that number is more than the figure in any full year since 2016. Palestinians have widely blamed the worsening situation on policies pursued by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The American president makes no secret of his extremely pro-Israel stance. Trump took the American support for the regime to a whole new level by moves such as recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. Palestinian groups now say the U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between several Arab states and Israel is further emboldening the regime. How can Palestinians now trust the U.S. as it loudly brands itself as a mediator between them and Israel? Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say these Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, the people of Palestine are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
After months of chaos and hundreds of thousands of deaths worldwide, an end to the crisis triggered by the deadly coronavirus pandemic could be within reach. U.S. biotech firm Moderna has announced its experimental vaccine against COVID-19 was 94.5% effective. The announcement would make it the second major breakthrough in worldwide hunt for an effective vaccine. Moderna has announced that its newly developed vaccine would pose no significant side effects.
At the end of this trial, if the efficacy dropped down to 80% or even 70%, this is still really a very good result and a really strong reason to be optimistic to have a vaccine and very soon vaccine.
According to the data provided by the company, its vaccine was given in two doses 28 days apart, and the preliminary results are based on 95 volunteers of the 30,000 who fell ill with COVID-19. Just last week, U.S. drug maker giant Pfizer, along with its German partner BioNTech company, announced the invention of a separate effective vaccine against the deadly virus. According to scientific reports, a key advantage of Moderna's vaccine is that it does not need ultra-cold storage like Pfizer's, making it easier to distribute.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, these are really good results, although they are interim result, early stages data, but yet these are really exceeding the expectation, because what we expected in the scientific community and also the regulatory bodies were that we will have a coronavirus vaccine around 60 to 70% effective. And this vaccine, both of the vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer results are more than 90%, which
the vaccines are viewed powerful tools to fight a pandemic that has infected 54 million people worldwide and killed 1.3 million. The news also comes at a time when COVID-19 cases are soaring, hitting new records in the United States and pushing some European countries back into lockdowns. Next year, the U.S. government could have easy access to more than 1 billion doses just from the two vaccine makers, more than needed for the country's 330 million residents. Other European nations are expected to have easy access to the vaccines. Head of the World Health Organization has hailed the rapid progress towards a COVID-19 vaccine, but insisted that every country had to reap the benefits from the vaccines. Never in history has vaccine research progressed so quickly. We must apply the same urgency and innovation to ensuring that all countries benefit from this scientific achievement.
And I can announce that we have today secured an initial agreement for 5 million doses of the Moderna vaccine.
Tedros Adhanom has said other countries could not wait for bilateral agreements to get the vaccine, since the process could take years to negotiate. There are now concerns that richer countries could monopolize the distribution of the vaccine. Western nations have already ordered millions of the doses of the vaccine, potentially leaving poorer countries in Africa and Asia without supply for years to come. It's feared relatively wealthy nations will likely be able to vaccinate their entire populations.
The first agreement that we reached with the U.S. government was for an order of 100 million doses. So we anticipate to be able to ship up to 20 million of those 100 million before the end of the year. So we are making product, as you know, every day and stockpiling it. And assuming we get the green light from the FDA, I would say sometime in December, I'm sure General Perna from Operation Warp Speed will be ready with the trucks to load the product, and to distribute it in the US. We have a CDC guidelines.
The EU has already ordered 200 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine, while the UK has ordered 40 million doses. People in low-income countries could be waiting until 2024. Drug-making companies could also benefit profusely from the world's deadliest pandemic in recent memory. Pfizer and BioNTech could make $13 billion from coronavirus vaccine.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden's popular vote lead over Donald Trump has now stretched to more than 6 million as he continues to rack up the highest number of votes in American history. The Democratic challenger and now president-elect currently has 79,823,827 compared to President Trump's 73,786,905, itself a record for a losing candidate in terms of sheer number of votes cast. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Biden's Popular Vote Lead Over Trump Stretches to More Than 6 Million. Stay with us for more. Joe Biden's popular vote lead over Donald Trump has now stretched to more than 6 million as he continues to rack up the highest number of votes in American history. The Democratic challenger and now president-elect currently has 79,823,827 compared to President Trump's 73,786,905, itself a record for a losing candidate in terms of sheer number of votes cast. Biden's win in the popular vote tally has also delivered him a convincing mandate in the all-important Electoral College, which actually decides who becomes the next occupant of the White House, after flipping states like Georgia, Arizona, and the Midwestern Rust Belt states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. However, it has not stopped Donald Trump and many of his Republican allies from seeking to undermine the result of the election by launching a series of lawsuits and technical objections and asking for recounts. None of the tactics have shown any evidence to back up Trump's false claims of widespread ballot fraud. Joe Biden, who has denounced Donald Trump's attempts to reverse the election results as totally irresponsible, was spending Saturday meeting with transition advisors as he draws up his administration. Donald Trump was scheduled to participate virtually in his last summit, the summit of the G20, the 20 biggest world economies. Senior Republicans have remained largely silent about Trump's unsubstantiated claims of election fraud or have defended his right to seek redress, but pressure was building after several voiced doubts on Friday. Two Republican sources said a press conference on Thursday, at which Donald Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani accused Democrats of engaging in a national conspiracy to manipulate vote totals whilst conceding that he had no evidence, may have been a turning point for some of Trump's former allies. The General Services Administration, run by a Trump appointee, still has not recognized Joe Biden's victory, preventing his team from gaining access to government office space and funding normally provided to an incoming administration ahead of the inauguration day on 20th of January. The president-elect spent his 78th birthday on Friday in his home state of Delaware at work on government transition, including a meeting with Congress's top two Democrats, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. In 2 months, Joe Biden will take the reins of a politically fractured nation facing the worst public health crisis in a century, high unemployment and a reckoning on racial injustice. As he wrestles with those issues, Biden will be attempting to accomplish another feat, demonstrating to Americans that age is but a number and he's up to the job. Biden will be sworn in as the oldest president in the nation's history, displacing Ronald Reagan, who left the White House in 1989 when he was 77 years and 349 days old. The age and health of both Joe Biden and Donald Trump, less than 4 years Biden's junior, loomed throughout a race that was decided by a younger and more diverse electorate. Out of the gate, Biden will be keen to demonstrate he's got the vigor to serve. It's crucial that he and his staff put himself in the position early in his presidency where he can express what he wants, with a crispness that's not always been his strength, said Ross Baker, a political scientist at Rutgers University, who has advised legislators from both parties. Ross Baker added, he has got to build up credibility with the American people that he's physically and mentally up to the job. Meanwhile, senior Republicans are pressuring Donald Trump to drop his corrosive fight to overturn the 2020 election. Trump faced growing pressure from Republicans on Sunday, 22nd of November, to drop his chaotic last-ditch fight to overturn the U.S. presidential election, as Victor Joe Biden prepared to start naming his cabinet, and a Pennsylvania judge compared Trump's legal case there to Frankenstein monster. Despite Republican leadership in Washington standing behind the president's claims that the 3rd of November election was stolen from him by nationwide voter fraud, other prominent figures within the Republican ranks, including two of Trump's former national security advisors, were very blunt. Former Trump national security advisor John Bolton said Biden would be sworn in January. Bolton added, the real question is how much damage Donald Trump can do before that happens. The president's efforts were designed mainly to sow chaos and confusion, John Bolton told CNN's State of the Union show, as a demonstration more of raw political power than a genuine legal exercise. John Bolton noted that the Trump campaign has so far lost all but two of more than 30 legal challenges in various states. Right now, Donald Trump is throwing rocks through windows. He's the political equivalent of a street rioter, Bolton said. Another former Trump administration national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, told CBS's Face the Nation that Trump's efforts were very corrosive and warned that his actions were sowing doubt among the electorate. It's playing into the hands of our adversaries, H.R. McMaster said, warning that Russia, for example, doesn't care who wins the election as long as many Americans doubt the result, undermining America's democracy. On Sunday evening, hours after former New Jersey governor and advisor to the president Chris Christie said Trump's legal team was a national embarrassment, the campaign issued a statement distancing itself from lawyer Sidney Powell, who has been a prominent figure arguing the Trump case that the election was fraudulent, whilst positing wild theories, but with no evidence. Meanwhile, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, another Republican, said he also was confident that Joe Biden will be sworn in on schedule on 20th of January. Larry Hogan said, I'm embarrassed at the lack of party leadership speaking out to recognize the election result. Larry Hogan added that he thought Trump's pressuring last week of state legislators to somehow try to change the outcome of the election was completely outrageous. The U.S. used to supervise elections around the world, but was now beginning to look like we're a banana republic, Larry Hogan told CNN's State of the Union politics show. Hogan later tweeted in response to a critical tweet from Donald Trump, who had gone to the golf course for the second time in this weekend. Hogan tweeted, "Stop golfing and concede." Larry Hogan's full tweet reads, "If you had done your job, America's governors wouldn't have been forced to fend for themselves to find tests in the middle of a pandemic, as we successfully did in Maryland. Stop golfing and concede."
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, my Deen. Allah, my Lord. His word, Quran. Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم Welcome to Youth Station, everyone. You're here with us at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Mehdi, and with myself I have my friend and co-host here, Hamza Hosseini.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam. Hamza, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Before we start, I'll just try to explain what we do here. We've got different topics that people might have in their minds, questions, and we are trying to have a general conversation about it over here. So today, the first thing we're going to be speaking about is, what are the elite? As you know, everyone in their gatherings in society, they've got different people who are known as elite in that society. So what really defines elite, the word elite?
So elite, in my opinion, well, what is known around worldwide at the moment, elite are like the people who are at the top of the range kind of thing, you know? Like, for example, if you look in the West or anywhere else around the world, elite are either known as the people who have the highest of qualities within education, or they have the highest status, like financially, like presidents, people of the government, or people who have the most knowledge. We can put it into that context as well. Like, for example, if we want to put it into financial situations, like, the elite are the most rich. But whereas if we put it into the educational, like, point of view,
the more learned you are, the more learned you are.
Or, like, for example, we can put it this way as well, like, the most elite scholars, right, that we have nowadays, like the Marajas, the Ayatollahs, and the high-end scholars that are in that. But what mostly comes to people's minds is the elite forces or the elite system, which is in any kind of society, like the rich people or that kind of thing. Whoever has the highest capacity or the highest quality in any kind of thing, you call them, like, if you want to go according to the verbal dictionary or whatever, you can say that the people who have the most of something in any subject.
Yeah, fair enough. Like, Da Vinci is the elite of art. So in terms of art, Da Vinci and Picasso, I think, you know, people like those, they're the elite, and we still have museums that host their paintings and stuff like that. They're valuable. In terms of science, you know, Einstein? Well, you know why I'm talking about these people, because I want to bring it back to our elites. Mm-hmm. For example,
scholars, right?
Yeah. But like, in terms of all these fields, for example, art or science, like
arts
in art
of Islamic science, so.
Arts and Islam. Yeah, yeah. Like, for example, art.
There's a lot of artists that are well known in Iran. I don't know. I did see a video which went viral on Instagram and YouTube recently. It was of this girl. I think she was from Tehran or something. She was disabled, but she would write with her and draw paintings with her feet. It was amazing. Unfortunately, I forgot the name.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
So we do have artists in the Islamic world as well, but they don't get like publicized as much as, you know, Picasso and these guys.
True. I'm trying to focus about the old school people, for example, Avicenna and all those people. You know, Avicenna was a boss at medicine. You know, he's the elite. Like, we have our elite in medicine is
Ibn Sina.
Yeah, Ibn Sina or Avicenna, mostly in the West, that's how they know him. For example, with Sheikh Bahai.
Sheikh Bahai.
You know,
yeah.
We've got like a prodigies like these people. Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari. He's known in the Western world also.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You know,
that's
like,
right.
Are these our elites or are they generally all over the world?
When we say elite, either we want to take the verbal sense of it, which is taken from the dictionary, right? Or either there's elite, which is well known in society, like such as these high rank religious authorities and stuff. And they're well known of like the elite of our Muslim or Shia societies, right?
So, you know, I like the fact that you distributed these two things, the most widely known people who are elites, right? Yeah. But then you said there's another thing that's a formal definition. That's more, you know, if it's all right to put it this way, civilized, you know?
Yes.
There's a specific ranking and all that. Not just a general opinion. For example, right now we think whoever owns the most wealth is the elite in the world, you know. For example, like, not very appropriate to take the name. I don't like to take these names, but, you know, still Rothschild, for example.
Yeah.
You know, these people are known as the elites of our world.
There's also that group, isn't it, that say controls most of the wealth of the world as well.
They actually run the game right now, you know. All these lobbyings and stuff like that. These people own the power. Is it all right to, you know, be submissive to these people? And is it all right to be submissive to those other elites that we talked about, the civilized elites, for example, you know? As you mentioned, they're like some religious scholars, authorities, right? Are you not supposed to be submissive to what they have to put forward and tell you in terms of knowledge, right? Well, we learn from them. That's different. Like, that submission is a bit different to this submission, isn't it?
I think it's 180 degrees in the opposite direction. If we want to follow some kind of elite power, which we look at, like, for example, these rich families I'm saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have nothing to do with Islamic values or human values at all. They just have, like, power, which they have that moderate power over people, which is just, like, for showing off, basically, you can say, right? Or trying to get their way. Whereas if you look at, on the other factor, like the Islamic elites as the verbal, like, formal description, as I would say again. Yeah, so we don't get both of them mixed up. So these ones are actually, or these elites of such as the Marajas or the Ayatollahs, right? They're showing us the right path. They're showing us how to live a life, right? How not to live under oppression and stuff like that. Whereas the other ones, they just want to control us by their power. So that's the difference between both of them. Whereas one, we're getting our Islamic values shown, how to live a perfect life, how to live within society. The elite, we were saying that we have the Maraja within our society, right? But they are not well known to the outer world. Probably just a few people within the Islamic society, or even probably a few Islamic students or the ones that come to study over here. And then the rest of the people probably just hear their names here and there, but they don't actually hear their qualities and how the other elites are well known within society.
Even in these scholars that you talked about, besides the fact that they were, in terms of religion, masterminds, you know, like in terms of they had the knowledge that they used to produce, you know, besides those people also that we'll come back to, we mentioned Sheikh Bahai right now, you know. It's mind-blowing that he'd been able to crack the codes of, I don't know, how the gas under the bathroom, you know, old school bathrooms. There was steam rooms and they used to go for bathing over there. It was lit by one candle. Do you know that?
Wow, yeah, I did actually go and see a few museums. But it was amazing, like, the science that these guys used and how much it obviously took some kind of research.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like how you compare it, like, oh, one of the Western scientists who apple fell on his head and he was, wow, that was gravity, man. You had to actually, like, sit down and do some research for that.
Yeah.
But these guys aren't well known in the outer world.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone who come after them and they'll copy the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they'll become well known.
Jabir ibn Abdul Ansari. Have you ever heard of whom he learned from? We'll be surprised.
You'll have to enlighten us.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Our sixth imam. Isn't that mind blowing? He's so famous, but where his roots are, that's not well known. Why? Propaganda. I don't know. Uh-huh. Is that so?
He's well known within the Islamic societies, right? But if you go and look into the West, it's not that well known.
Yeah, you're right. But like, even in Islamic societies, man. Because, right, we live as Muslim nations, right, in different worlds. But our media is still, like, almost one-sided. So myself, it's been a few years that I found out that there was a person like that. Rather than being, you know, a toddler or a child, that we hear about all these elites. For example, Einstein. Everyone says Einstein. Children say Einstein, right?
Yeah.
But they hear that. They don't even know him.
How the media portrays it, actually. How the system works. And how everyone wants to learn everything from the West. Whereas if they look in reality...
Which is the most famous library that you know about?
It's in London.
Or yeah. Oxford, for example.
Oxford Library, yeah.
What's special about those libraries?
And then there's Central London Library as well, yeah.
Yeah, what's so special massive. About it? That's it. It's massive.
Yeah.
Like, I could just build a large place and fill it up with random books and, you know,
yeah.
Get to know it.
The library of Agha Marashi Najafi is going to say that, wasn't he? Look at all the struggles that Ayatollah Marashi has been through just to build up this library in Qom, and no one in the world, like, hardly knows about it.
Yeah, you're right. Being a Muslim, I'd never heard about it until I was here myself.
Yeah, you know, same here as
I had no idea. Just for a brief for everyone to know, you know, it's very interesting to go and look at how this library was built and what kind of books there are in there. This person that we're talking about, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, he wasn't financially very well. And he had this passion for books and mm-hmm. knowledge that he went out of his way to... just gather all these books, which have, you know, become...
Like him and his wife used to keep fasts, and, like, they call them...
For example, some people have passed away and they haven't been able to fast in their lives. So there's this system that people provide the opportunity for someone else to be able to keep those fasts, and they pay them not a very considerable amount for that thing.
They used to do that, and then Ayatollah Marashi Najafi, and this is how I heard the story, that he was going out and he was going to buy some stuff apparently, and he had seen one Englishman and he had came to buy like some really old books, right? Mm-hmm. Islamic books. So this guy was there in the bookstore. Well, I think they used to just have them, like, on the sides at that time, right?
They still do.
Yeah. At like, in the side of the alleys, right?
Yeah, they still
like,
do.
That's how... And he was collecting them all. So, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi asks the guy who's selling the books and stuff, he's like, why is this guy buying all these books? Where does he want to take them? So, apparently, he found out that this guy, he wants to take all these books and go and put them into the Western libraries as antiques. So then after that, Ayatollah Marashi Najafi came to this conclusion. He said that if they take all of our knowledge, like 100 or 200 years down the line, we'll have nothing left.
Hmm.
Because it's all our hard work, right? We're going through all these struggles, our scholars. They've given lives for this knowledge.
Hmm.
So what he done was he came up with this excellent plan. And with all these fasts and stuff, like as you explained. And after that, him and his wife, they went through all this hardship just to make this this library, which is near the shrine of Hazrat Masum. 90% of the people who come here.
Ancient scriptures, handwritten. Firstly, they're antiques. Secondly, they're handwritten, all of them. Well, not all of the ones, all of them in the library, but like their books, which are like those. And imagine... People, if they knew about this, for example, when you go to a country and certain countries are famous for certain things, yeah? You go to a country and you hear about this library that it's got all this stuff that this library has over here, you'd actually visit that city just to visit that library. But like we have people who who live here or who visit this place but have no idea that there's a place like this that
yeah,
you
exactly,
could visit.
That's,
you know?
That's exactly how it is.
For example, like I'd like to mention Ayatollah Jawadi Amali. For example, these people are elites, you know. It's been 30 years that they've been lecturing on one book, which is the Quran, right? When you look at a science, you never say that, wait a second, this theory or this law wasn't there 100 years ago, so how has this person come up with this law, right? You exactly. constantly wait for these people to come out with a conclusion and provide us with, you know, something new, right? But when it comes to religion, we don't have that enthusiasm or, you know, that inquisitiveness that we can go around and find out if there's new knowledge being spread about for us, you know. 30 years, and he's been lecturing on the Quran. Apparently, it's a small book, but like 30 years, and they've been still on about exegesis of the Holy Quran. These people are elite that we actually encourage people who are listening to us to actually go out and find out about these people. For example, like Allama Hilli, it's mind-blowing that at the age of 9 he was knowledgeably one of the high authorities of jurisprudence of Islam at the age of 9. And the only reason he was not officially accepted was because there's a rule that you have to be you have to reach puberty before you are considered as an authority, and that was the only reason he was not an authority at the age of 9. Imagine that. What kind of elite do we have that we're not aware of, you know?
We don't have the enthusiasm, right, for these elites. I think that the enthusiasm comes alongside with something like when it's famous, right, or well known in society, it becomes a trend and a mode, right, what they say. So for example, when a child is really small, right? They look at someone really famous, soon, like, for example, when small, like David Beckham or something like that.
Yeah.
And because why? He was well known in society and he was really famous. Now, exactly like that, we're lacking a little bit of something here as well. For example, getting the names and the attributes and the speeches and the knowledge of our Ayatollahs or our Islamic mirages and stuff out to society.
It's our job right now to actually go out first and look at whom we have, and after we find out for ourselves, we actually promote those people and let people know about them. Thank you for being here, Hamza. I hope that you do join us.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, until next time, everyone that has been with us, take care. And from myself and Hamza over here,
goodbye from me too.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. That everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
around the world with reporters.
Israel launched airstrikes in the early hours of Sunday on the Gaza Strip, causing damage to surrounding areas, but no casualties reported. Israel claims the airstrikes targeted Hamas positions and came in response to a rocket fired from Gaza toward the southern city of Ashkelon, the second time in 2 weeks.
Israel is not committed to its responsibilities, refusing to allow in the required ventilators for the enclave amid the coronavirus pandemic. The resistance front preserves the right to give a crushing response to those violations.
The Palestinian group say they will continue their resistance as long as Israel is imposing its crippling blockade over the impoverished enclave, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic and the shortage of medical equipment and ventilators.
It is the resistance movement's duty to defend Palestinians against the Israeli aggression under any condition. Israel should be held accountable for the deterioration of the Palestinians' lives. This is a crime against Gazans.
Observers say Israel's refusal to meet the basic needs of Palestinians increases the possibility of further escalation.
The ongoing conflict comes as a result of Israel's suffocating siege on the Gaza Strip over the past 14 years. Palestinians won't remain silent. Through strikes like the recent ones, Israel is seeking to cover up its internal problems.
Israel has been conducting similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months.
The resistance groups here stress they are ready for any possible escalation, and the resistance will go on until the crippling siege on the Gaza Strip is broken. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
With almost 100,000 children under the age of 5 at risk of dying, Yemen slides into a dire situation. Here lies the 9-month-old Munir struggling to survive a severe malnutrition.
This is my son Munir. We've been here for a week. We want to treat him for malnutrition, and God helps us. We're resisting this savage war.
The ongoing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia has brought a severe famine described by the UN as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
There is an increase in malnutrition cases. Yemeni children are suffering from malnutrition in all governorates, and we receive 50 to 60 cases per day. There is a shortage of medical equipment like CT scanners.
The UN's former humanitarian coordinator for Yemen described the country's food security status as catastrophic. Now, a UN analysis shows that the coronavirus pandemic, economic problems, and the war have pushed malnutrition the highest levels in some parts of the country. According to the UN study, malnutrition has risen 15% among children under the age of 5 this year.
We condemn and denounce the continued international silence about the blockade imposed on Yemen and the failure to take any measures against the Saudi coalition, which has exacerbated human suffering, especially for children.
Millions of children in Yemen could be pushed out of starvation by the end of the year as the humanitarian crisis is compounded by the ongoing war and the blockade, along with the pressure of funding shortage as the world grapples with the coronavirus pandemic. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A large number of people turned up in the garrison city of Rawalpindi near Pakistani capital Islamabad. These angry youngsters were outraged against India over its alleged unending brutalities against Muslims in disputed Kashmir region. So were they resentful against Israel for suppressing Muslims in the occupied Palestine.
Equally, these protesters are angry with the rulers of many Arab states over their alleged collaboration with India and particularly with Israel in strengthening their illegal hold of territories belonging to the Muslims. But it seems for these protesters, there is a leadership vacuum in the Muslim world.
This protest was organized by Youth Parliament, an organization of students of colleges and universities from all over Pakistan. They have been campaigning to forge greater unity among Muslims across their racial and sectarian profiling and regions. With greater unity among the ranks and files of Muslims, these students are struggling to bring an end to the atrocities being committed against Muslims by reviving the true spirit of Muslim nationhood all over the Islamic world.
We will never accept Israel. They are bombarding on the small children in the Palestine. They are Muslims. We are standing with them, and they are looking for the Pakistan, that they should come for the help for the Palestine.
The protesters sounded disappointed with the Prime Minister Imran Khan, who won last general elections partially with the pledge to pursue Muslim causes. Muslim causes in the world appears to be what matters to the common people in Pakistan. The lingering public resentment against France over repeated publication of blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of Islam is yet another cause these students have been fighting for. This protest has followed gathering of millions of people on the streets of eastern city of Lahore a few days ago. Such a huge crowd emerged to attend the funeral of Khadim Hussain Rizvi, a religious and political leader who through his sustained protest forced Prime Minister Imran Khan last week to ink an agreement with his government to expel French ambassador and officially boycott French products in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Rawalpindi.
According to many independent institutions like Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, some Australian troops have committed crimes against humanity, such as intentionally killing civilians, since the beginning of America's longest war in Afghanistan back in 2001. A recent report on Australian forces' potential war crimes in Afghanistan has provoked reactions from Afghan institutions. Afghanistan's Human Rights Commission has condemned the killing of civilians by Australian troops and urged the prosecution of those responsible for the crimes. Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has dismissed as an inhuman move the killing of dozens of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Unfortunately, Australian forces have brutally killed civilians, including men, women and children in Uruzgan province. In fact, it proves that the lives of the Afghan women, men and children have no human value or dignity for them. Unfortunately, 39 civilians were killed by Australian forces during their 11 years presence in Afghanistan.
This comes as experts believe there is not much optimism that independent investigations would be launched, even at the International Criminal Court, into the case of killing of Afghan civilians by Australian troops.
Although grounds are available to probe the case by the International Criminal Court, interference and pressure by certain powers have created serious obstacles in the way of launching investigations into war crimes in Afghanistan.
Based on a recent report released by the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, more than 32,000 civilians were killed and around 60,000 others, including women and children, were injured over the last decade. That is why the UN body also believes it's time to put an end to this human tragedy and misery by struggling to bring peace to the war-ravaged country. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands in Paris, tens of thousands all over France are protesting for the second time in a week against the global security law. This new law has been voted in the French Parliament and makes it illegal to film and publish images of police officers. For these demonstrators, this new law is a violation of the right to inform.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Even at the very beginning of the sanitary crisis, with the total confinement, the police were controlling everybody, asking for their certificate to be able to leave their residence, you know, even though it could eventually be defendable from a sanitary point of view. Now, it has nothing to do with that. This proposed law is not directly connected to the sanitary crisis at all, and they are just giving more powers to the police.
Earlier this week, the police used tear gas and water cannon when protesters took the street in front of the French Parliament. With the new law, it will become illegal to film this kind of police intervention. During the Yellow Vest movement, videos have been used in judicial investigation concerning police violence. With this law, the French state can more easily hide illegal actions committed by police officers. It can also more easily hide scandals, which opens the door for abuse of power.
For us, this law doesn't only concern journalists. During the Yellow Vest movement, we have seen an explosion of police violence. One of the important arms to fight against this is the ability to film the police violence and to denounce it. So this law is also against us, not only against journalists. There is also a surveillance of demonstrators by drones.
The French government says they want a better protection for their police force. But the new French law is seriously criticized by the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, as well as by a large spectrum of the French civil society, journalist associations, trade unions, political parties and human rights defenders. 1 year of prison and 45,000 euros of penalties, that's what someone risks for publishing the face of a police officer. Many people here say that the French government is using the coronavirus crisis to limit personal and public liberties. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The U.S. presidential election remains unresolved, but what seems crystal clear is that the nation is more divided at any time than since the 1960s, or perhaps even the 1860s. A new poll found that nearly 80% of America says they are deeply divided on its most foundational values. Whoever is inaugurated in January will face a deeply mistrustful and disbelieving public. As the poll also finds that just 30% of Americans believe the country will grow more united in 2021. For a nation which is the richest in the world and which faces no serious external threat, such levels of disharmony are shocking even to many Americans themselves.
The far right, that's really come from almost like Trumpism, if that movement still stays strong, we can see more conflict in the next 4 years. And I think it's really just dependent on how Joe Biden kind of handles the next 4 years and also what kind of information is really getting flown out of the far right and whether that gets filtered or not or whether that gets spread very rapidly.
Distrust is not something which grows overnight. Many attribute the division to the American liberals' obsession with so-called identity politics, which divides and redivides people into smaller and smaller tribes based on gender, race, ethnicity, urban, rural, coastal, inland, and on and on. U.S. conservatives are criticized for having a limited view of unity due to an us versus them mentality, which leaves little room for change or modernization.
Right. I think that Republicans and Democrats have become almost like their own tribes where they're not willing to give an inch to the other. I hope that's not going to continue. And I hope that the rhetoric becomes less incendiary as we move forward. But I don't think that Trump is doing anything but fomenting more discontent among groups of people that are already tribalized and having a hard time getting together.
The United States is proving unable to resolve a host of enormous problems. Protecting from the coronavirus pandemic, Great Depression-era levels of unemployment alongside a skyrocketing Wall Street, endemic economic inequality which has exploded in 2020, constant racial discrimination, record disharmony between genders, a Congress which is half as popular as an often deeply unpopular president, and of course, a disputed election, the third in six tries. The poll makes it clear that belief in the nation's division is not a partisan issue, as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all agree in similar proportions. Americans can only seem to agree on one thing, that they really, deeply disagree. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Capital Sana'a hosted the first scientific conference on cancerous diseases with a focus on gynecological cancers attended by a large number of specialized doctors and academics under the sponsorship of the Yemeni Health Ministry.
We thought about enhancing the role of person, individual roles, community.